All right, welcome to Brain Health with Dr. Nissen. Today we're going to be beginning a series on ADHD, Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. It's a disorder that a lot of people have been hearing about these days. Many people are familiar with it, and there's a lot of controversy around it. And so what I'm hoping to do today is clear up exactly how it's diagnosed, what some of the background is as far as the neurobiological and genetic underpinnings to the disease, and then also to begin to talk about, as we'll do in some of the future sessions, about what are some of the different treatment options available, be them biological in nature, like supplements or medications, or be they more psychosocial in nature, like different types of therapies and behavioral interventions. The behavioral interventions and therapies are definitely a focus area of mine. And so we will definitely dig into those later. But to begin, let's really lay the groundwork for what attention deficit hyperactivity disorder is. So ADHD, or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, is a neurobiological condition, and it typically presents in childhood, and indeed that's one of the diagnostic sort of criteria, is that it presents in childhood and that it has these core symptoms of inattention, hyperactivity, and or impulse control problems based on sort of your individual mix or the person's individual mix of their inattention, their hyperactivity symptoms, or their impulse control problems. They can be then diagnosed with different subtypes of ADHD. The symptoms of ADHD are present across multiple domains, be it social, domestic, academic, or in the workplace, and they can manifest in both cognitive or behavioral ways. So the pathogenesis, or basically the development of ADHD, or the biological underpinnings of it, it's not super well understood, but there have been many different studies looking at ADHD from a developmental perspective, from a neuroscience perspective, and from a brain anatomy perspective. And so some of the different anatomy studies that look at, you know, how is it that our brains are different in people that have ADHD versus people that don't, they found that there are differences, real differences, and significant differences in the frontal subcortical areas. And these are the areas of the brain that are responsible for executive functioning. So you may have heard of executive function before. There will be a different part of the series that goes all into what executive functioning skills are. But these are the areas, these are these skills that are associated with the frontal and prefrontal areas of your brain. These are things, again, I'll get into them later, but, you know, things related to impulse control, emotion regulation, attention and focus, planning and organization. All of these different, you know, components of executive functioning are what are related to these frontal and subcortical areas. So it makes sense that they would find that these areas in people that have ADHD would be different from somebody that's quote-unquote neurotypical or that does have intact executive functioning skills. There have also been seen that there's some variation in the memory areas, and this has to do with working memory. Working memory is like if you are like memorizing a phone number, right? 8675309 or whatever. There's sort of this memory that we hold for a short period of time that we can reproduce, and we use that sort of short-term memory in order to carry forward in a task, to carry our attention from one thing into the next. And that can be something that is affected in people that have ADHD. So they, you know, might forget what they were working on. They might forget a detail that somebody just told them, and that's because they have this impairment in their working memory. And then related to that is problems with information processing. So, you know, somebody says something to you, teaches something to you, and you don't properly integrate it or be able to say it back to them. And then speed deficits, that they may not be able to take in new information as quickly as somebody else. So the neuroimaging research that's been done shows these structural brain abnormalities and that's seen in smaller volumes of the frontal cortex, as well as parts of the cerebellum and subcortical structures. as well as in the prefrontal and parietal circuits. And related to that is that there's some early studies that are now suggesting that some of these differences in the subcortical structures, so the structures that are kind of more deeper within your brain, that those do perhaps normalize after childhood, but that as we get into adulthood, the cortical abnormalities, or the abnormalities on the more outside parts of the brain, those persist. So that's interesting, and it gets into another part of this conversation about ADHD, which is, well, how real is it? How isn't this just something that everyone has and they need to get over it? Or isn't this something that all kids have that then they just grow out of after a certain period of time? And that's a tricky question to answer, because a lot of things in psychiatry are things that all of us can, we experience to one degree or another at some point in our lives. And what makes something different in psychiatry between, you know, being part of the normal human experience and being a disease is if it's something that causes significant dysfunction in your life, if it's debilitating, and also if it's something that you really aren't able to come up with any solutions for. So oftentimes what I say to people is, you know, you may think that, you know, a psychiatric problem like ADHD is no big deal, and that's probably just because you haven't ever seen severe disease. You might think that a psychiatric problem like depression is not a big deal, but that's because you've never seen a severe case, like somebody that has major depressive disorder with catatonia. Somebody that has catatonia, they literally, you know, are not able to move. Their physical motions are actually separated from their own intentions and their thoughts, and that's really severe form of major depressive disorder. Similarly, in ADHD, you can have somebody who's literally not able to take in, you know, a phone number that you say to them and say it back to you. And you can think about how impairing that would be if they try to have a job. You can think about how impairing that would be if they're, you know, sitting in a classroom or something like that. So, you know, just keep in mind that the idea with ADHD is that it's, you know, at the far end of this spectrum of attention and hyperactivity, so inattention, hyperactivity, and impulse control problems. And if you don't think it's real, you may just not have seen a severe enough case of it. That being said, you know, just because somebody has ADHD doesn't mean that they need to take medications. It doesn't mean that they need to take a stimulant medication. And this is something that we'll talk about later, which is that there are things that we can do over our lives to either grow out of ADHD or improve, or basically make it to the point where our attention, impulse control, and hyperactivity symptoms don't have any significant impact on our lives. And that's the goal. That's my goal as a therapist, as a psychiatrist, and as a psychopharmacologist, is to reduce somebody's symptoms to the point where they're able to function well and where it doesn't have a significant impact on their life and where they're essentially able to work like any other person could. So that being said, there is this biological underpinning to it that I'm discussing here. You know, related to these structural changes, there's also some evidence for there being an underactivity of the dopamine and norepinephrine circuits in this frontal subcortical circuits, and a hypoactivity of the dopamine and norepinephrine neurotransmitters in the frontal subcortical circuits that contributes to this, which is part of why if you use a stimulant medication, or if you're constantly seeking out stimuli and novelty, these things are going to boost dopamine and they're going to boost norepinephrine, which helps somebody with ADHD to feel more focused. So related biologically to the picture here is the genetic picture, which is that there actually is pretty good evidence of a genetic predisposition for ADHD. When you compare somebody that has ADHD to siblings or to parents, you see that there's a 2 to 8 times increased risk of having ADHD if a family member has it. And then similarly, twin studies where they're looking at twins and seeing, you know, variations in the degree of ADHD, you see that there's 76% heritability of ADHD. So it does have a strong biological underpinning. So what is it? What is ADHD and how is it diagnosed? The core symptoms are hyperactivity, impulsivity, and inattention. We tend to clump together the hyperactivity and the impulsivity, which is that somebody just kind of does something immediately that comes to their mind. And so they might, you know, in a young kid, which can be perfectly normal, is that they, you know, get up and run out of their chair. Or they might, you know, impulsively blurt something out. And then inattention is different from that, which is sort of an inability to kind of hone one's mind on one area. So hyperactivity and impulsivity almost always occur together in children. So it does tend to be that the hyperactivity in particular is something that does tend to resolve. And the hyperactivity and impulsivity tends to manifest as excessive fidgetiness, so tapping the hands or feet, squirming in their seat, difficulty playing quietly, excessive talking, difficulty remaining seated when sitting is required, like in the school environment, being difficult to keep up with, being always on the go, excessive talking, difficulty waiting turns, blurting out answers too quickly, and interruption or intrusion of others. So as one listens to this, as I do, you think, well, how much of this is really a neurobiological problem? How much of this is a symptom of the sort of educational system that we have today, which may seem completely unnatural to have a child sit down and pay attention and not be expected to move, have them be fidgeting, you know, getting out of their chair, running around, climbing up things, or blurting out answers too quickly. You know, how much of that is a problem with the educational system versus a real neurobiological problem? And I think that that actually is a valid question. And that's part of the intervention here, is not just, you know, not only medications being an option, especially, you know, I work with adults, not with children. And so for me, it's a bit different working with people, but you want to develop the skills to be able to pay attention and to be able to control an impulse to get up and run around and climb things. You want to develop that, and that can be developed through therapy and skills and not necessarily just through medication. So I do think it's really important to focus on those skills interventions. And it's also worth thinking about, what are the right learning environments and classroom environments for these kids? Is it the case that you know, need to treat them until they are just sitting in their chair, or does the classroom environment need to be modified for them to where they're running around more, they're doing things outside more, they're, you know, going and exploring and learning? And I certainly myself advocate more for that, of trying to be creative with the educational solutions rather than changing the kid, to try to change the educational environment as much as possible. That's something that I think is some nuance here that is definitely worth discussing. But through all this, I want to think more through the lens of adult ADHD rather than child ADHD, just because I'm not a child and adolescent psychiatrist. And also, it's just something that's growing in popularity, is, you know, people that are either in college or new in their career, or even later in their lives, that are thinking that they have ADHD. So that will be sort of the lens that we're talking about going forward here. So hyperactivity, impulsivity, the hyperactivity component tends to be worse from the ages 4 to 8, and then tends to decline after that age. But the impulsivity component of it may persist. And certainly, like in adolescence or in young adulthood, impulsivity may look like some risky behaviors, be it risky sexual behavior, risky spending, substance use, risky driving, or getting in frequent accidents. All right, so that covers the hyperactivity and impulsivity side of symptoms. Now we're going to talk about the inattention side of symptoms. So inattention is having a slow cognitive tempo and really having difficulty holding sort of the spotlight of your mind on one thing for a, you know, significant period of time. And so you can be appearing to daydream, to be off task, or nowadays, you know, looking at your phone, on your smartphone, scrolling, when you should otherwise be focusing on something else. So the symptoms that are listed and are part of the diagnosis include a failure to provide close attention to detail, making careless mistakes, having difficulty maintaining attention in play, school, and home activities, seeming not to listen even when directly addressed, failing to follow through with homework, chores, or things like that, difficulty organizing tasks, activities, and belongings, avoiding tasks and requiring constant or consistent mental effort, losing objects, being easily distracted by irrelevant stimuli, or having forgetfulness in routine activities like homework, chores, or morning routines. So these inattention symptoms tend to manifest or show themselves more a little later, around the ages of 8 or 9, and they tend to be more of a lifelong problem. So it can manifest as academic problems then in those middle school and high school years. And that's oftentimes when people go and seek help. So again, the three components here, we're talking about hyperactivity, impulsivity, and inattention. The hyperactivity does tend to go away, or people tend to grow out of it, but what can persist into adulthood in adult ADHD is the inattention and the impulsivity. So in order to be diagnosed with ADHD, somebody would need to have impaired functioning in multiple different domains, academic, social, or occupational. As part of the diagnosis, there will be a medical evaluation, and that's really important because sometimes people will, you know, say that their therapist says that they have ADHD or that their school guidance counselor says that they have ADHD, but it really requires a full medical evaluation. And why is that? Well, there's several different things that could look like ADHD but really are not ADHD. If somebody from when they're in the womb has prenatal exposures to tobacco, alcohol, or drugs, if they have perinatal complications or certain infections, if they get meningitis or encephalitis at some time, if they have any head trauma, if they have lead exposure, if they have recurrent ear infections, or they have hearing problems, or if they have sleep problems, all of these things are very common causes of symptoms that look like ADHD but really not, and so you don't want to be treating the wrong thing. Similarly, there I have current medications. People can have attention problems as a side effect from different medications. So the medical evaluation is really important to determine, yes, this is ADHD, it's not something else. As part of the medical evaluation is also the family history. As I mentioned before, it's really common for somebody to have it if their family member has it as well, due to this high heritability. So for diagnosing ADHD, oftentimes we use these different rating scales. Some of the most common are the Vanderbilt Assessment Scales and the ADHD Rating Scale 5. These can be completed by parents, caregivers, or teachers. In younger people, what's often done is an educational evaluation where you have a teacher fill out one of the rating scales, as well as give some feedback about the students' classroom behavior, the interventions that have been tried, their learning patterns, and their degree of functional impairment in school. And then as part of that as well, their report cards and any other work samples. That's important because, as I had mentioned before, in order to be diagnosed with ADHD, it must be present in multiple different contexts. So, you know, having those, the educational component to go along with also what the parent or the patient is describing helps to describe those multiple contexts. There's other mental health disorders and neurological disorders that should be considered, which are learning disorders, language disorders, autism spectrum, sleep disorders, tics, depression, anxiety, substance use problems, oppositional defiant disorder, and conduct disorder. Most commonly, there's depression and anxiety, as well as autism spectrum. These are, again, very common, and sometimes, you know, people will say, oh, you know, I'm having trouble in class, I'm not focusing, but also I've been, you know, feeling really down and don't feel like living anymore, and my parents recently got divorced, and it's pretty clear that they are either having an adjustment disorder or a major depression, and that's what's making it very difficult for them to focus on anything. So there's other evaluations that can be done other than a psychiatric evaluation. It could be that we would refer to a speech and language evaluation, an occupational therapy evaluation. I would maybe check blood lead levels, a TSH and T4 genetic testing. There's some different genetic conditions like Fragile X, Klinefelter, and ALD that could cause some of the symptoms of ADHD. Sleep tests or in lab sleep studies could be important. If somebody has obstructive sleep apnea, they can certainly have cognitive clouding throughout the day that could look like ADHD. And then oftentimes in young people, there can be a concern for absence seizures, which are seizures that kind of look like spacing out. And so it can look a lot like ADHD, and it needs to be diagnosed with a neurologist and with an EEG in order to find the seizure that's happening that doesn't result in your, typical sort of tensing up or flailing like you would expect from a different sort of seizure. All right, so the next part here is the psychological and neuropsychological testing. People that are interested in ADHD have often heard about neuropsych testing, or they've been told that they're required to get neuropsych testing. So neuropsychological testing is, neuropsychology is a particular area in psychology, and so psychologists can specialize or become a neuropsychologist, and they sort of own that domain. And what they're often looking for is problems in cognition, problems in learning that are seen in ADHD. And so it's a really thorough evaluation, but depending on whether or not they're using a battery of neurocognitive tests, it may look very similar to a psychiatric evaluation for ADHD, which would be looking for these symptoms of inattention, impulsivity, hyperactivity, when they began, the impacts across multiple different contexts, and ruling out some, other possible causes of those symptoms. So all of that being said, ADHD is a clinical diagnosis, and neuropsychological testing does tend to be very expensive and difficult to find. And so it's not routinely recommended for somebody to get neuropsychological testing unless there's some reason to believe that the ADHD picture is particularly complex or it'd be helpful to facilitate the diagnosis in some way, or they need to track the progress. So it could be recommended for a more complex case, for maybe an adult that also has like a change in their memory that looks almost like a dementia or something like that. So it could be recommended for a more complex case or for helping with a learning disorder or specific executive functioning deficit that could impact the sort of therapy or treatment that you're going to use. But in general, it's not necessary for most people. So for the diagnosis in kids under age 17, you need to have six or more of the following symptoms in the hyperactivity impulsivity realm, or six or more in the inattention realm. So the symptoms are the ones that we had mentioned before, all of the hyperactivity and impulsivity symptoms, or all of those inattention symptoms. And then plus that, these symptoms must occur often in more than one setting for more than 6 months and with an onset before the age of 12. And it must impair their function, be excessive for their developmental age, and not due to something else. That is basically the diagnostic criteria in order to be diagnosed with ADHD. And so in adults, we'll talk about in a little bit, it's slightly different criteria here. But the diagnosis can be ADHD predominantly inattentive. So that would mean that they have six or more of the inattention symptoms, but not six or more of the hyperactivity and impulsivity symptoms. Or it could be ADHD that's predominantly hyperactive impulsive, which would be six or more of the hyperactive impulsive symptoms, but not six or more inattention symptoms. Or it could be ADHD combined, and most commonly it is the ADHD combined type. So adult ADHD is a whole other sort of fish to fry, a longer conversation, but basically the short of it is that it is possible to diagnose somebody in adulthood with ADHD, but essentially what you're diagnosing is a case that's missed in childhood. And that is very possible that, somebody, it's very difficult to access a psychiatrist when you're young, or they for one reason or another weren't able to be assessed for or diagnosed with it at that time. But if they did have these symptoms in childhood, and it did impact them across multiple other contexts, and it has been impairing, then it is possible to be diagnosed with ADHD in adulthood. For older adolescents and adults, the criteria is slightly different in that you need five or more of the symptoms rather than six or more of the ones that I mentioned before. And then still, the adult ADHD must not be due to something else. And that's one of the most common issues here, is that somebody comes in, they think they have adult ADHD, but they're also depressed, or they also have generalized anxiety disorder, or they also have bipolar disorder. And so it's really not so clear whether their attention deficits are due to a depressive problem, or to an anxiety problem, or to a manic or hypomanic problem, or to a substance use problem, also very common. So it really requires a thorough evaluation by a psychiatrist to determine these things. But that's it for this episode. So this is talking about ADHD, the different features of it, the neurobiological underpinnings, and then how it's diagnosed. What we're going to talk about further in this series is some of the different things that you can do to treat or reverse your or prevent your ADHD. And so all of these things are really important. What we're trying to do is look for, different distractions that we have in our lives. For many of us, the smartphone is a major distraction, and so we need to use different, systems to keep these distractions from popping up in our lives. I know for me recently, I was finding that I was looking at my phone too often, either when I was trying to work, or I would like binge, scroll on my phone, doom scroll at night as I was, about to go to sleep. And then I would, not get as much sleep as I wanted to, be so, upset, like, what the heck? And so what I did is I installed Zenzi, which is an app that you can use on your phone to time the different apps that you want to block. You can set like a schedule. And so I have mine now blocked from 9 p.m. onwards, and Zenzi will keep me from opening up Instagram or Facebook or whatever from that time. And it's been great. I'm able to sleep a little bit longer now, and also it's kind of it feels good to just feel a little bit more control over those things. So we will talk a little bit more about some of these other behavioral interventions as well as the biological interventions in future episodes. But until then, I hope you have a good day, and I wish you good brain health.